Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you. Hello, and thanks for listening to another episode of All Better. I'm your host, Joe Van Wee. Today's guest is the Honorable Mark Powell, Lackawanna County District Attorney. Mark has made combating the opioid crisis a top priority of his administration. He is the co-chair of the Lackawanna Recovery Coalition, which works to reduce opioid overdose deaths in Lackawanna County by connecting people with substance use disorder to treatment, implementing life-saving harm reduction strategies, advocating for long-term recovery, and working to reduce stigma surrounding the disease of addiction. In October 2019, District Attorney Powell established an overdose fatality review team to study overdose deaths in Lackawanna County to determine the root causes of addiction-related deaths and implement evidence-based solutions. D.A. Powell also initiated a Fresh Start program for lower-level drug offenders to supplement treatment court. Fresh Start gives offenders the chance to choose treatment instead of jail and avoid having a criminal record. He is also a board member of the Lackawanna County Treatment Court, which established and operates the Recovery Bank in downtown Scranton, a peer-driven recovery support center that focuses on whole person healing of mind, body, and spirit. We had an episode last week with its CEO and chair, Frank Bullock. D.A. Powell is on the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association Executive Board and serves on its Education and Training Committee. In addition, he was appointed by the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania to serve on the Continuum Legal Education Board, which oversees education programs for attorneys statewide. Before being elected DA, Powell was a partner in the Powell Law Firm in Scranton for 27 years. He earned many professional accolades, including distinction of being a board-certified trial specialist in both criminal law and civil law by the National Board of Trial Advocacy. For 12 years, he served as a hearing committee member for the Pennsylvania Disciplinary Board and is a past president of Northeastern Pennsylvania Trial Lawyers Association. He is a past co-chair of the Lackawanna County Bench Bar Conference and serves on the Lackawanna Bar Association's Continuing Legal Education and Bench Bar Committee. D.A. Powell frequently teaches CLE seminars for other attorneys across the state. In 2016, the National Institute for Trial Advocacy awarded him the Teaching Excellence Award at the Advanced Trial Advocacy Program. D.A. Powell earned his undergraduate degree from Villanova University, his Juris Doctorate from Catholic University, and his Master of Laws in Trial Advocacy from Temple University, where he graduated with honors. Let's meet Mark. We're here with Lackawanna County District Attorney Mark Powell. Thanks for coming in, Mark.
I'm glad to be here. Hope I don't disappoint.
No, not at all. Mark, I guess I want to start in with your kind of personal life and history here, rooted to the area. Off mic, you were indicating this history starts a long time ago.
Yeah. So I'm actually third generation lawyer. My grandfather started our family law practice back in 1906. And he was an interesting man. He was orphaned when he was 13. His parents, who had both migrated from Ireland, had located here. And in 1888, they were involved in the Mud Run disaster, which was a train wreck that killed about 64 people from the area. And he was orphaned. And ironically, the train wreck was actually a movement to avoid alcohol consumption. So it was a 20,000 person march in Hazleton. About 10,000 people from northeastern Pennsylvania got on trains and went to Hazleton to participate in this march. And on their return home, two trains collided right around the Lehigh Gorge. It's called Mud Run because of the area of the river. And tragically, my two great-grandparents were lost. And, you know, at the time, that was a pretty big disaster. But for my grandfather, it was devastating. He's 13 years old. He had a little bit of an education, but certainly not enough to survive. He worked in the coal mines. He became a slate picker. I guess he was quite good at it. He worked his way up to be the mule boss. And, you know, the story at the time, you know, a mule boss was a pretty valuable position, because the mules were more valuable than the men.
Yeah.
And he did that to survive.
Or the Irish.
Yeah. So he did that to survive, but he had a strong conviction for schooling. So he never dropped out of school. He was raised by his oldest sister and continued his education, ultimately getting his college degree, became a teacher for years, became the superintendent of the music school. And all during this time as a young man teaching, he studied law at night and ultimately opened our practice that now is 117 years old.
That sounds extraordinary. First, the visual of 20,000 people showing up for the demon rum to stop drinking. I think people tend to forget what that looked like for about 40 years. It was a real conflict. It would be.
Sure. And then this would have predated Prohibition. But clearly shows that alcoholism has been a problem throughout history and was a particularly big problem that plagued the Irish back in the late 1800s. And this movement really was a front for abstinence, to get people back to be productive workers, productive fathers, and productive members of society.
Yeah, it was a plague, and it is from the start. There's a rich history that I discovered as I got sober, starting with Benjamin Rush, kind of giving the first description. This might be a disorder. This might be a disease. Martha Washington started, you know, the teetotaler kind of Washingtonian society. And the temperance movement kind of brought more of a fanatical approach to it. Alcohol's the problem, not culture or the mind, and we're here today, I mean, which is a lot more humane, at least the discussion, which we'll get into. But
yeah, we certainly have a much better understanding and know it's a treatable condition.
Yes, absolutely. What I'm also interested in, the Irish, your grandfather's an orphan at 13, but some value in a 13-year-old mind was instilled for education, specialization, lifting up out of out of the coal mines. Yes. This is in the midst of labor movements, just the first John Mitchell. This is kind of the same time period, right? Where kids were still working in mines.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Joe Van Wee. I'm the host of All Better, but I'm also the CEO of Fellowship House. At Fellowship House, we believe long-term recovery requires a personality change as well as a clinical intervention. These ideas can take several months to achieve. Our philosophy is to provide a safe, therapeutic, and exceedingly active environment for patients to achieve these personality changes and find joy in the fellowship of recovery, which will allow for long-term sobriety. We believe that recovery extends beyond treatment and peer-to-peer communities into real life. In Fellowship House, we provide a design for living that focuses on education and service. We have strong relationships with the 12 universities and vocational schools in the area and ensure that our fellows pursue their personal goals while entering sobriety. We also stress independence and responsibility, making sure each individual is financially solid and self, and helping to make their community a better place. As a treatment center, Fellowship House offers both residential and outpatient treatment services to individuals and families affected by addiction and alcoholism. We're a DDAP licensed provider of general outpatient, intensive outpatient, and partial hospitalization programming, as well as a level of care assessments. If you want to find out more information about Fellowship House, please visit fellowshiphouses.com.
Yeah, no, I amazing respect for him. You know, he persevered and through great adversity.
Wow.
And was became an incredibly respected lawyer in town, had 8 children. Education was always key. All of those 8 children were college graduates. All 8 children were teachers at some point in their life. They all received educational degrees. So there, I always grew up with this strong sense that education was important and constantly learning was important.
Yeah.
And I really value that principle. I of course never met my grandfather. I only know of him through the stories of my dad, but my dad was probably the most influential person in my life and a great man in his own right. Also a lawyer. And I really followed him around since I was a kid. I can remember wanting to be a lawyer at 5 years old. I declared it to my kindergarten class.
Yeah.
And I never really lost focus of that goal. And that goal really carried me through difficult times. Now, not as difficult as some of your guests, right? I've had a pretty good life. I am not in recovery. I'm very supportive of the recovery community, but
yes,
I'm not in recovery. Alcohol has always been a social part of my life growing up. And I think I have a pretty good perspective with it, but it never consumed my life. I just never had any of those addictive qualities. I was very focused. I knew what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I knew how I had to do it. I had my struggles. I had to work extra hard. I failed. I failed forward. I failed backwards. It wasn't this dreamy-eyed childhood with no adversity, but I do believe adversity in whatever form does make you stronger.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm always so inspired when someone is in recovery and has a success story, because they really have put very difficult times behind them. And they're good people with a bad disease, and you can see that. And when you see people who have, I was just last night at a meeting and there are people in recovery 20, 30 years and amazing success stories. And it's just truly inspirational.
We are spoiled here. I believe I know the event, but it's not uncommon to meet people that have 20, 30 years still active. It's not like, oh, I got better, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
I'm going back to what I'm calling my life. It becomes their life. You have to pull other people out of the ditch. It's kind of how you keep it.
As I was leaving the event, a colleague, friend of mine, who I knew was in recovery and has a successful recovery of at least 30 years, just kind of pulled me aside and said, each day I want to drink, and each day I go to a meeting, and each day I get by and convince myself that I don't need that drink. And each day I feel better when I don't drink. And that's pretty amazing to think that, 30 years sober, he still struggles with his condition. Now he's handling it successfully. But it's a difficult challenge on a day-to-day basis.
It is. It's The esoteric way to describe recovery, maybe in a short sentence, one way is connection. There's a disconnection. And listening to your rich history that you're speaking about your grandfather, who you haven't met, but why you are, is connection. Your story started long before you. It's not just trapped and marked. Some people never get that perspective, and it keeps the humility that dues were paid long before I got here to have. That's a great perspective of life, and it's rich, and it's carried on from dad to son. Sometimes that gets broken, and I meet that a lot in addiction. You get so, you know, trapped in the idea of self, my story. You forget all the variables that happened to create this, and you lose your sense of gratitude of what was done before we got here.
Yeah, and I think there were just basic sound principles. I'm, you know, very blessed to have such good parents. My mother was truly the most religious person I've ever met in my life, and I don't mean to discount her influence with me. Truth be told, I'm probably more like her than my dad. But my father was a very powerful force. He was a successful lawyer. I wanted to be a lawyer. He had just tremendous qualities, and he did instill those qualities in my life. And so, you know, the one we talked about, which was just this constant hunger to learn. He instilled humility. Like, I'm sure he wasn't a humble man because he was, a very sought after lawyer, but boy, he certainly acted humble and had gratitude, in everyday, actions. And he was also, very compassionate, you know, just very compassionate. He did criminal defense work, most of his life, but he was always just so caring and compassionate for his clients. And that's what I grew up with. He literally, you know, took me into the Lackawanna County Prison when I was 9 years old. Wow. I don't think you can get away with it now.
That's an exciting field trip.
And I remember, I won't talk about the guy's name, but he was a member of the Hell's Angels.
Yeah.
And he had a scar on his face from about right above his left eye all the way down to his throat. He was a scary, scary guy.
they still are.
but to my dad, he was a client, and he was a gentleman to my father. My father was representing him at the time. But those are the kind of the experiences I had growing up. I actually met that individual many years later. Yeah. When I was in college and hanging out at Cockeye Oscars and was in the men's room and really got the heck scared out of me when I saw this gentleman and I remembered his name, and he was, you know, not causing any harm, but I remembered his name, and I said hello to him, and we made the connection with my dad, and of course he took me under his wing and treated me well that night, but it was just a compassion for your fellow human being that my father possessed. And he was a fierce advocate for his clients, but he just possessed that compassion and understanding and forgiveness. And that's really the qualities I grew up with.
Yeah. Well, we're painting this rich history, which I wanted to do. And it's with an intention of how much has changed 200 and 100 years with concepts, ideas, more humane ideas of what addiction is and why it would cause criminality. So you see that rich history. What was your first personal experience of realizing what addiction was, or realizing you misunderstood what it could be in your life?
I'm sure I didn't have a really good perspective of it other than maybe 5 years before I decided to run. So sometime in the, say, 2010, I started. So I guess let me back.
Sure.
So, you know, life moves forward. I follow my dreams. I go to law school. I become a lawyer in 1990, and I joined the family firm. Unfortunately, my father had passed away at that point in time, so I didn't have the benefit of practicing with him, but clearly he was with me every day. And even to this day, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think of something that he said or some guidance, but I had a very successful practice for 27 years. I practiced with my brother and my cousin and truly enjoyed the work I was doing. But I was doing criminal defense and plaintiff's personal injury work. And I began, after doing this for about 25 years, seeing the real impact drugs and alcohol had on individuals. So doing criminal defense work, most crimes were fueled by some form of drug addiction.
Staggering. It's like in the 90-80%.
Yeah. So if someone was robbing a store, it's usually because they were fueling some of their addiction. Some were downright dealing drugs.
Yeah.
So I clearly saw that as just being so pervasive in every aspect of criminal law. But also on the personal injury side, I had many clients who were in chronic pain and fully addicted to prescribed opioid medicine. And they were zombies. They were walking zombies. Yeah. And it's a difficult balance because I'm sure their injuries were legitimate and I'm sure they were in pain, but they, at that time and the
tolerance progression, it steals the entire idea you have of yourself. It disappears.
Yeah. So, and this is when, not the best practices were being followed. There was definitely an overprescription by doctors and clearly back then, most of the folks who were turning to heroin, about 75% of them or 75% of them were getting first hooked on prescribed medicine.
Wow.
And insurance companies then would cut back on the prescriptions and then people who were fully addicted didn't have any choice but to turn to street drugs and use heroin.
And this was common? You were seeing this?
And we were seeing this. I didn't have, the best understanding about it. And I was kind of believing what was being told to me by the medical profession that, this is how we treat chronic pain. It's palliative. How do we do anything? We can't just operate on everybody. And it's not that that's untrue, but it's not the justification for the amount of drugs that they were pushing on
not
patients
at
the time. Yeah. So, I'm doing this for now, 25 years or so. And I start to really get a better sense of what's going on and how individuals with use disorders are really consuming the whole justice system, not just the criminal justice system, and how bad it truly is on a day-to-day basis. And there must be a better way.
Yeah.
There must be a better way. And then I had the opportunity to, run for political office, run for district attorney, which was a leap of faith, right? I had a very secure practice.
It was exciting. It was a very exciting race. It was historic for our county. I loved watching it, seeing it. You have my support. It was exciting. Very exciting.
Yeah. And different for me, right?
Yeah.
Way out of my comfort zone. I was always, I think I'm most comfortable in a courtroom. So
sure.
Wasn't really on the political circuit. I would be the guy writing the checks, ever thinking I would run for political office, but also kind of reaching a point in my career where life was good. It was a good opportunity for a change. And this is as comfortable and as happy as I was practicing in this family firm and fulfilling this dream I had since I was five, I just thought there was a really good opportunity to do more and actually give back.
You were pretty transparent. I saw you showing up at events, and this is maybe a year or two prior. So, it was Whisper Mill. Mm-hmm. You were eyeing this up. But getting to meet and talk to you throughout the years, I'm like, oh, he's driven by public service. You wanted to do something that was more fulfilling. You knew you were capable of doing. And that's why I was excited, because you were non-political. And I knew you were really wanting to serve the public. You had some ideas you wanted to change.
It really was, I can't say the best decision of my life because my wife would get mad at me, but it was close to the best decision of my life. And certainly professionally the best decision of my life. And it was a hard decision because I walked away from that family firm and who I practiced with my brother and my cousin and
a big
partner for many, many years who I, still respect and miss dearly, but it was the right move at the right time. And it really did allow me to do more. So just, a typical criminal defendant you'd represent and you know,
you understood changes that needed to be made, that you're trapped in working in the confines of what was happening. I mean, I see it. And I saw you going to recovery events and I was like, something's up here. Like, I don't see this often unless it's, you know, a ribbon cutting. You were going to openings, events. I saw you talking to clinicians. I'm like, Mark gets this. And that's why I wanted to have you on today. Yeah.
And I still do, right? Yeah. I still go to these events because I enjoy them and I learn a lot. And I think it's important to support people in recovery. So what I realized in doing criminal defense work, I could maybe help one client at a time. But in my role as district attorney, I can actually implement some policies that help a lot of people. And we had good policies in place. So we had a very successful diversionary drug court that was in existence for 20 years that Judge Barrace created. Yeah. And I fully supported that. But I saw gaps. I saw that it really didn't address some low-level drug offenders. Mm-hmm. And what's important with lower-level or first-time offenders is to get an assessment. Now, not all of them have use disorders, but if we can assess them early and track them, then we can know whether it's a true use disorder or just a pretty bad mistake.
So an assessment kind of unfolds. Someone gets before a licensed social worker or a therapist, and they see what degree of addiction. If is it addiction, is it another co-occurring condition? And from there, you start to make assessments of what should be done with that person?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we get those assessments. If there's some treatment, we'll provide some treatment. We'll certainly provide some information. And we're talking, you know, kind of simple possession type cases.
Use.
And so we then we'll work out a small diversionary program where we get those charges dismissed and expunged so it's not hurting them and hopefully they're on the right track. What we find is some of those people come back, but now we have a baseline. And now we can work with that in future treatment programs to get them on the right track. So that's called our Fresh Start program, but we implemented that. I'm very proud of it. It's working. It's progressing. And it hopefully will continue. And it filled that void with low-level drug offenders that just didn't exist before. People would plead, go to probation, really not get treatment, you know, not get hurt too terribly in the criminal justice system, but you know, end up with something on their record.
Yeah.
But not getting their needs addressed.
It could be life-changing. Some petty offense from being an addict or an alcoholic could change the entire course of your life with that leverage charge. You see the Fresh Start program as at least a lane of change that what is coinciding with the drug court. Get the assessment. Are these real charges? Is this person a criminal? No, they're an addict. Let's get them help.
Right.
Is that kind of... That's not happening everywhere.
No, but when you talked about are there changes in the criminal justice system, there are. I think the movement and the reform that's valid is along those lines to get folks treatment, get away from just putting people in jail or jamming people up with criminal records they can't get a job 5 years from now because of something they did when they were 18 years old. So there are positive movements in that regard. And I feel very strongly that folks who are involved in recovery programs deserve that break. And we have several diversionary programs. Our Veterans Court is very successful. And it's limited to veterans, but it's much like any of the other diversionary drug courts. But it's peer-to-peer help with veterans helping other veterans. And they respond better with veterans helping veterans, right? They relate just like someone... you know, who has been in recovery, working a program and helping someone in the initial stages of recovery is very helpful. It's, you know, it's certainly better than me lecturing them on what to do because I don't share their experience. I may sympathize with them. I may support them. I may understand what they're going through, but I can't relate to them. Candidly, I just can't. I haven't lived that experience. But I know well enough that if I get someone in there who is in recovery and working a program and giving back to that program, I'm not only helping that individual stay on the straight and narrow because they're vested and working the program, but we're helping the individual who's starting the program. And that is the magic sauce. It's right. It's one to kind of get over the physical dependency. But that's just the start. I mean, there's just a whole other mental component to it. And then there's the giving back and working the program. And those are the people who are the most successful, because when they're working the program and giving back to others, they're really helping themselves.
We're covering a rich history. And just to put it kind of in perspective one more time, which I like doing, 100 years ago, it was illegal to be an alcoholic in a lot of counties. It was an alcoholic insanity. Lose your liberty. You're a burden to everyone. Your family, no one knows what to do with you. And usually made it to late stage addiction at 40, and it was an ugly death. You had to be out of eyesight. Let's put this person away. Fast forward to 100 years, just from the tenure of the 80s and 90s, you used to become an attorney. You're starting to see this meshing of trying to peel apart what is criminality versus mental health issues. And we're kind of in these forged changes, especially in the last 20 years, concepts changing, ideas, and that they're working. Where do you see it going? Like, there was so much that has changed in the last 20 years of what you thought, or myself, or how I was raised with in the 80s, this is a crime. Well, okay, that's a crime, but what's the mind that committed it? Like, there's a trauma here. There's addiction. That's going to get confusing. How are you parsing that?
So the crimes are still on the book, right?
Yep.
You know, there's still public drunkenness. And some of the crimes that really don't avail themselves to treatment are the crimes that cause harm to others.
Yes.
So like our DUI statutes that result in an injury or death, they're still treated very
seriously,
because there have to be consequences to those actions. And you know, my whole approach, so that I I'm very proud of, because when I look back at some of the speeches I made 5 years ago, that vision has become a reality. But I looked at this opioid crisis as really a two-part solution. We had a focus both on the supply and the demand. And,
okay.
and the demand is all of the things we're doing with the diversionary programs to promote recovery.
Okay.
And if we could reduce that demand, ultimately, we're going to stop the revolving door. We're going to get people on the right track. So we're very supportive in our office of the recovery plans. And I hope moving forward, that's what our courts are looking at. The laws are still going to be on the book. I mean, there are cities and states that have essentially decriminalized a lot of these drugs. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big fan of that, because I don't think that's the answer.
Okay.
But I certainly am supportive of mitigating the consequences for the action and getting people help and recovery. And that's hopefully where we're going, and expanding those programs and sustaining those programs, because they work. We know they work. I also thought we needed to do more to reduce the supply. And a lot of that is beyond the capabilities of law enforcement in Lackawanna County. It's really our federal government that really needs to
stop. It's almost a military operation at this point.
Yeah, to stop the drugs coming in. And we know what, you know, the drugs are being manufactured in China and India and Mexico, mm-hmm. and they're all coming through the Mexican cartel. And particularly with something like fentanyl, they're so small in quantity, you can, you can mail them and get them. So we have seen more and more fentanyl on the streets. It's mixed with more and more. And we, as far as law enforcement is concerned, have to do a better job to stop the supply of those drugs. So those cases we take very seriously.
Yeah.
So, and again,
they are joint kind of operations with state, city, federal.
Often, and certainly in communication on how they come in. But
so you got two lanes. I mean, you got this one where it's almost an operation of defense, and it's way beyond the scope of Lackawanna County. But the other lane, which really interests me, the humane piece, is the Fresh Start program and decriminalization of drugs, where it begins and ends, from marijuana to something of the effect of heroin that you could see, in the Netherlands, injection sites. I mean, that could be its own episode. But maybe just to bore down on Lackawanna County, the Fresh Start program, how has fentanyl changed this? And what have you seen in the last 2-3 years, the distress of COVID, fentanyl's everywhere. How is your office? How is this?
We really have a couple issues going on.
Yeah.
In the last couple of years. So, and our numbers, because of all of our harm reduction efforts, significantly went down in 2019. So we had great progress. So we know the programs work. We know the harm reduction programs work. Then the pandemic hits. So yeah. Now there are these added stress for people with use disorders. There's isolation, there's anxiety. There's an inability to get treatment because you can't go to a meeting, yeah. Right? And believe me, everyone did their best and yeah. Zoom helped, but it's just not that personal connection. So you have the pandemic affecting recovery and unfortunately our overdose deaths had increased despite all of our efforts. Now, without our efforts, I think they'd be 10 times worse.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have more fentanyl on the streets than ever. So it's the gasoline to the fire. Fentanyl is available everywhere, and it's mixed in everything. So it's cheaper. It's probably half the cost it was 2 or 3 years ago. It's more available because they're pushing it into the community mm-hmm. more and more, and they're mixing it with everything. So you have a couple things on the horizon with fentanyl. One, it is literally being laced in everything.
And when you say everything, I want to pause there because, you know, I grew up in the 90s. People who would venture into maybe cocaine use, college, heavy binge drinking. This is a safe drug. You can walk away from, like, you know, are you seeing cases of fentanyl being mixed with cocaine as well?
Absolutely. So that's cocaine, meth, heroin are primarily its sources. We've seen it laced in marijuana joints though.
Oh my
so
God.
Really, that is, you know, psychotic. Nothing's safe. One of the great things we're trying to do for harm reduction is have fentanyl testing strips available, which are technically
yeah.
illegal because they're drug paraphernalia, but allowing individuals to at least test the substance they're going to use so they know they're not getting fentanyl
yes,
if
yeah.
their intention is not to get fentanyl.
Are you working with this city and the county? Is a position being formed that this could happen?
It is,
it's
but
complex,
it's not as complex as it,
needs a bold move.
we're being told it's really such a simple procedure. But okay. Right now, I can tell you on the state level, we're optimistic it'll pass in June and be decriminalized. So sometime this summer, we're very
great.
Hopeful that our fentanyl strips are going to be allowed. But fentanyl really is in everything, and we're also seeing it in counterfeit form. So one of the real scary things right now are a lot of on the dark web folks ordering drugs thinking they are Percocet or Adderall and they're pure fentanyl disguised as a pill like Percocet. And I, you know, I have a good
it's psychotic
friend.
In my view, there's three complexities with that. I've experienced people we were working with. Was sober a couple of weeks, ordered some, what they were calling at the time, research chems from the dark web, arrives at their house. They're sober 3 weeks. They do it. They're dead. This yeah. here, Lackawanna County, a couple of years ago, yeah. another kid has substance use disorder, starts to get a, you know, promising start ahead of him for 4 months, he's taking anxiety attacks, doesn't have his script for, he was taking Xanax, goes down to Kensington, buys a pressed pill of Xanax. It was all fentanyl. Killed him.
Yeah, and they're lethal doses of fentanyl. Like one pill can kill. They're being shipped that way so drug dealers can cut them. But even your drug dealers, you know, they're not the most scientific labs. There's
yeah.
a lot of cross contamination, maybe even unintentional. They're not understanding or appreciating the dose. So many of these drugs are lethal and you know yeah. and that's why the Narcan program is so critically important. So Narcan is the reviving drug, and we've taken great strides in our harm reduction efforts to get Narcan in the hands of everybody. It first started out with the police and first responders
yep.
and believe me, there was some reluctance there. You know,
it's crazy. Yeah.
You know,
now it's common
with the stigma. Like, why, they wanted to die, or, hey, I just revived him last week. I'm not wasting another dose. But we made, and this was, 5 to 7 years ago. We've made great strides in that regard. And law enforcement is very supportive of it. And I know several stories where people have been revived by Narcan several times.
Yeah.
And then tell their story on how they finally got it, finally understand, finally hit rock bottom. And now they're in recovery and they're giving back and they're working as counselors. And you just need one of those stories to kind of inspire you to understand that this is the right thing. So then we expanded the Narcan distribution beyond first responders to a leave behind program so that they didn't just administrate it, but if someone had an overdose, now they're leaving it with family. And then our office developed a mail-in program. So you simply can request it.
Really?
And we will mail you a free sample.
I wasn't aware of that. What's separate? And that's called Leave Behind?
It's a Leave Behind program. So all this information is available through the Lackawanna Recovery Coalition.
I'll have that attached to this episode.
Yeah, LackawannaRecovery.org. And that's, I co-chair that with Barb Durkin. And
she's
really
great.
A lot of these ideas and then the implementation of these ideas come from that group. But that group is far beyond the two of us. It's really some community leaders, medical doctors, rehab specialists.
CCBA. They're data-driven. And so what they're bringing to you, there's confidence behind it. These were policy. This is just obvious to you. This is driven by data.
Yeah, it works. So that mail-in program, and we've distributed 1,000.
How does it work? Can anyone request? Because the hurdle was you needed a script to have this in your home or for, as a public or a common person to get a hold of this life-saving medicine.
So you can get it by script. You can get it at a pharmacy, but you don't need that. You can simply write in and we'll mail you a copy.
Excellent.
And the copy will be all literature where you can get help, direct you to treatment, but also give you Narcan and a tutorial on how to distribute it. It's like a nasal spray. It causes no harm, but it can change a life. And then while we don't collect this data because it's anonymous who requests, we have had a dozen stories of people being revived. I did just last week, and one of the local chiefs said to me, he goes, "Oh, it was a rough weekend. We had two near overdoses. And Mark, your Narcan packet was in the bedroom. They used it." So we found that, people who were on the scene even before first responders are the family members. So if we can get Narcan in the hands of family members to revive someone, that's one more opportunity to save a life. So there's just...
This isn't
no
available
question this works.
Everywhere. I mean, this is still a kind of a battle for advocates of addiction and harm reduction across the country. And this is where Lackawanna County's at.
Lackawanna County is truly a leader. We have lots of great resources. We know what works. We need to sustain a lot of these programs, but we know what works. And Narcan clearly works. And so what we discovered then now, we're moving on a lot of different levels and we have a lot of good people doing it. But then we circle back and we have a nurse from a school say, "Well, geez, can I get it for the school?"
Yeah.
And now we discover, oh my God, the schools don't have Narcan. So we reach out to the superintendent. Some schools did, but many did not. So now we supplied the schools with Narcan. And we're expanding that program. We want hotels to have them. We want people to have them who are going to be in situations where they may use it. And one of the lives saved was someone who requested the Narcan. It was not because they had a use disorder or a family member with a use disorder, but literally a body showed up on her front lawn. And thank God she had Narcan and she went out and revived him and he lived. So the stories are real. It works.
Yeah.
I suspect there are more stories than the ones we hear about, but you only just need one to inspire you to continue the fight.
Big picture, you're telling a story to me of enlightenment. Sitting across from me is a district attorney who's doing humane and saving lives and being tough on the fronts of where violence and other people are victims of crimes to no fault of their own. It's a tough, that's two lanes now. You're constantly working it.
But you have to do both. You have to do it all. And you know, one of the things I'm very proud of, just last week, we received a $2 million federal grant to focus in on some gun and gang violence. But the gangs are the ones distributing these drugs. So it really is to stop the supply. Yeah. So we will put that money in place on the enforcement end and stop this poison from coming in the streets and stop the guns and stop the gangs from delivering the drugs. So we really put an impact on the supply, but no one solution is going to solve this and no one expert is going to solve it. So these coalitions are really valuable because we hear from all different experts and then we work together to try to implement some of these programs.
That's the safest thing you could hear instead of one person having a plan, that smart people, many smart people, 30, 40 are sitting in a room and taking, you know, every direction at this. And that comforts me to hear that. One complexity I hear about a lot, I wanted to ask you about, what is this happening in Lackawanna County? I had a friend in Colorado. Strike team comes out, does a sweep, say, to summarize, takes out all the drug dealers of this region. And the void was filled, you know, over the next coming weeks by outsiders. And they just see every time that happens, fentanyl spikes. It's like someone that's not even planting a flag for a long-term operation or relationships with the people they're selling with. And overdoses just go boom. Is law enforcement articulating what to do in that vacuum that could protect people if outside forces come in and just don't care what's in the cut of heroin, cocaine, marijuana? Is this a problem?
It's a problem. And if we take a drug dealer off the street, it's not long before another drug dealer replaces them. But what's the alternative? We have to continue that fight. We have to be very aggressive on the law enforcement end. And I do believe that, if we focus in on some of the gang activity, we can reduce that supply.
Yeah.
But we made this concerted effort with reducing opioids and meth spiked. And so you sit there and go, you know, how do you win? How do you win? But if you do nothing, we know it's going to be worse. And so you have to just be strong headed and know you're doing the right thing. And I truly believe our approach with both harm reduction and focusing in on taking the drugs off the street is the right approach. Is it perfect? No. Are we going to have drug users? Are we going to have overdoses? Yes. Really, the difference now with why we have overdoses, you know, because people in recovery are bound to relapse from time to time, but they're relapsing with a deadlier drug. So when they do relapse, sometimes that's fatal.
It's changed everything.
Yeah.
It changed everything. I could flounder through high school smoking pot and stale beer. You know, the consequences were low. I could flounder in that area for a while, but you could be in your first week of addiction and you're going to pay a price you're not willing to pay. You might not know that. It's how do you reach that person? Because traditionally, like, old recovery methods were you're not browbeating people. Do you want it? We could help. We'll do anything to help if you want it. That's changed because that person's life's in jeopardy within a week. And when you're in inpatient treatment, you got 30 days to break into that denial. Like, this is going to kill you faster than waiting 20 years. It's scary. It's really scary. Okay.
So we're doing a lot on a multiple different levels. And another source of this. So the Recovery Coalition is a great think tank to come up with ideas, but we also, through the district attorney's office, created an overdose fatality review team. And that was also funded by a grant we were able to secure. But we study each and every overdose death. We talk to family members. We get the history of their treatment, both in rehab and their exposure in the criminal justice system. Yeah. And we try to come up with solutions based on these individual studies, and we gather data, and it's really evidence-based, but there are clearly some.
And there's patterns you're seeing that
clear patterns, right?
Could develop an approach that.
Yeah. Clear patterns. And while every, you know, the demographics are different, we could be dealing with a man or a woman, old or young, wealthy or poor, but the consistent patterns always seem to have some type of, you know, drug use before they're 16, some type of childhood trauma, undiagnosed mental health issues. They're just consistent patterns. So then we try to figure out how to better address that. And that's where we come up with a lot of our harm reduction strategies. And so, you know, are we doing Narcan? Yes. But we are looking at other areas. So we know that the criminal justice system can be that good hammer or hook to get someone into treatment and then have some guidance with it. But then when someone, if they are incarcerated, they were typically not getting any treatment while they're incarcerated. And then when they were released, they had about a 10% more chance of overdosing because they got their first fix. They were either using at the same levels they did before, but they're now lethal doses because they don't have the tolerance, or they were getting heroin mixed with fentanyl and they were incurring these deadly doses. So we have programs now in the prison to address recovery, and then a kind of a reentry program where we try to help them as they get out of prison, not just getting jobs and housing and transportation, but to actually continue them in a treatment course. When someone goes into the emergency room and has a near overdose, we have a warm handoff program where they immediately get into treatment and recovery, and we provide those services.
Does that involve CRSs?
It does.
Peer-to-peer?
Yes.
So you implement the certified recovery specialist, which is it's a PA certification to have a peer-to-peer relationship, standard of ethics, meet the individual where they're at, and not declare one path to recovery. We'll give you all the info.
Right. And it's voluntary, of course. Not everybody takes you up on it. But when someone, you know, hits rock bottom, they're more receptive to treatment.
Yeah.
And, you know, coming out of an OR with their life saved is a kind of a attentive audience, right? You know, it's a good time to try to get their attention.
We always say that, you know, in some 12-step groups. Wait till the morning. We'll come over at the morning. Let them be.
Yeah. So there are a lot of great efforts in that regard. And because we know so many children are affected and kind of fly under the radar and don't get treatment, we're focusing in on some programs in the school. There's a program for drug-affected children who are the children of addicts and the impact on them. So there are some programs in the works. Of course, all these cost money. We need funding. Yeah. We're applying for grants left and right. So they're great programs. They're science-based. It's not just a social experiment. We know they work.
Yeah.
We need to fund them, and we need to support them. And fortunately, in northeastern Pennsylvania, there are a lot of resources for individuals. It's not a problem to go into rehab these days.
No.
I mean, you can get rehab pretty much anytime, anywhere. That's a good news, but it's beyond just going into a 28-day program.
There is a caveat there, and it's a trend. It's just starting. I don't know if you're seeing this. My fear is some of the newer business models of treatment centers are not servicing Medicaid, Medicare. It doesn't fit in a model that is like I'm going to have 20 Medicaid. It's more of a vocation, and you're not going to get rich, but wow, I think we need some more. We just shut down.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of this goes right down to Shikshini. There's a juvenile program, but I do see opportunities for entrepreneurs or someone with a vocation and a heart to fill that need in multiple states is more dignified treatment for Medicaid and county funds for the court system. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, no. And I've seen all levels. I just visited the Salvation Army the other day, and they're doing a really nice job.
Yeah, they do.
And I was a little surprised because I hadn't been there. And, you know, they house maybe 60, 70 men. And one of the rooms had about 15 beds in it. And I thought, ooh, that's some tough living, you know.
Where are you going to go?
But then I was told, you know, a month ago, they were sleeping under a bridge. So they're delighted to be there. They're in a safe environment. It's a clean environment. They're getting the treatment that they need. And they're getting the support.
I know a dozen guys, 20 years sober, Jersey, Connecticut, came here, got a job, part of the community, Salvation Army. Mm-hmm. It's hard to put perspective of what my taste or preferences are in religion and quality, but we've come a long way from the mud, the mud accident, what we understood about this to you know, your office now. It's huge. And for, you know, a wrap-up question coming towards an end, I wanted a little thought experiment. You know, so much has changed in the last 20 years, just with ideas and how we're defining this. Do you daydream in 20, 25 years, 30 years, where that office will be at and what they'll be defining as criminality or where the fight's being won?
Yeah, I hope we continue on the right path, and I hope we learn and continue to learn. I told you I'm a constant learner, so I'm always open to new ideas. I'm somewhat suspicious sometimes of some of the experiments that go on without the data to back it up.
Yeah.
And I'm very data driven in my decision making. And I understand the arguments, you know, like, you know, legalization of recreational marijuana is better because it's not going to kill you. I understand it, but it's still an addicting drug. And I can't make that argument that it's any worse or better than alcohol. Alcohol is an addicting drug.
Yeah.
But I hope we continue to learn. I hope we continue to provide these services. I know that once this pandemic passes, the harm reduction efforts that we have in place work, and they will continue to drive down the numbers of overdose deaths. I think medical assisted treatment has come a long way to help people. You know, personally, I'm not a doctor, and I don't know if long-term use is the right way, and I understand there may be a very small element of society that it is the only way.
Yeah.
But for the vast majority, I think it's a short-term aid to get people sober, and that's the goal with it. So I'll you know, defer to the experts in those.
Well, you meet with so many people, and that's profound. That's real leadership. You're listening to addicts, clinicians, doctors, administrators, human services. That's how it's going to be won.
Yeah. And I think all those factors are important. And again, we need to stop and reduce the drugs coming in. And it's scary because, every drug we reduce, it seems to get replaced. And historically, that has been the case, but we need to continue that fight as well. And that fight is as important as trying to help people through recovery. So, because if we can reduce the supply of the drugs, we're going to be reducing the use of the drugs.
Well, District Attorney Mark Powell, will you come back maybe annually for an update?
Absolutely.
I'll still be podcasting. I'm flattered you came and that you've been a friend and support to not only the recovery community, myself, and what I'm trying to achieve. So I want to thank you again.
Well, thank you, Joe. And you're doing great work. Really, the more we can get this out there, the more we're going to reduce this stigma. It really is a matter of getting the message out that this is a treatable condition. We need to talk openly about it. We need to let people know those resources are out there. That will solve the problem. Get rid of the stigma, get the treatment, get people on the right path.
Links below to all county resources and the programs we spoke about today will be found below in the comments section. Thank you. I'd like to thank you for listening to another episode of All Better. You can find us on allbetter.fm or listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and Alexa. Special thanks to our producer, John Edwards, and engineering company 570 Drone. Please like or subscribe to us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And if you're not on social media, you're awesome. Looking forward to seeing you again. And remember, just because you're sober doesn't mean you're right. Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you.